Atheist.
Atheist.
Don't have no songs.
Don't have no songs.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
It is important as mayors that we maintain and even enhance our connection to the people that we serve. We have to become our best communicators. And what I have learned over the last 8 years as mayor is that I have to be out there talking directly to the people. I have to be amongst them and tell what we are doing, listen to them, be accessible to them, and then hope that they too become your ambassadors. And so when they are seeing or reading stories, they themselves can say, that's not true.
Mayor Sylvester Turner of Houston, Texas. This past summer, the city of Houston played host to the National Urban League Annual Conference. The conference brought together major leaders from the business, government, and social advocacy sectors and served as a center for policymakers, political activists, and others to meet and exchange ideas, network, and develop strategies to address a broad range of issues. The National Urban League is a historic civil rights organization dedicated to economic empowerment in order to elevate the standard of living in historically underserved urban communities. The organization spearheads the efforts of its 92 local affiliates through the development of program, public policy, research, and advocacy, providing direct services that impact and improve the lives of more than 2 million people annually nationwide. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the African-American mayors of the nation's four largest cities in Black America.
Well, you know, following up on what you were saying, I believe that in our communities, we've worked for years and know the strategies to intervene and prevent crime. There's always the rap that Black folks are upset if it's a law enforcement involved death, but say nothing when it's Black on Black, which I reject that notion. That is not true. But unfortunately, the grassroots work that happens in all of our communities is never lifted up, and we need to invest more in that. When we went through the time period of mass incarceration, which is not like it's over, but it's a little bit different now, you know, laws were passed to lock us up for everything under the sun, including what I believe were health, social, and economic issues that should not have required incarceration.
Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles, California. The first two African-American mayors were elected in 1868, the year the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution was adopted. However, it would take another 100 years for an African-American to be elected mayor of a large U.S. city. In 1970, Newark, New Jersey, and Dayton, Ohio, both elected African-American Democrats as mayors. During the 1970s, cities like Tallahassee, Cincinnati, Detroit, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and New Orleans elected their first African-American mayors. Today, more than one-third of America's top 100 cities are governed by African-Americans, many of them men, women. Also today, the four largest cities in America are led by African-American mayors. This past summer, the National Urban League held its annual conference in Houston, Texas. On the second day of the conference, President and CEO Mark Morial held a fireside chat with Mayor Sylvester Turner of Houston, Mayor Eric Adams of New York City, Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles, California, and Mayor Brandon Johnson of Chicago, Illinois.
Ladies and gentlemen, first time on stage,
These four represent experience, power, and promise. So let's give it up for these four great mayors of major American cities. Now, Mayor Turner.
Yes, sir.
You're the OG here now. Brother Turner, because of this thing called term limits, you don't have them in Chicago.
Don't even bring it up.
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Welcome to this week's edition of Ebony Spectrum.
Professor Ron Daniels is the president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And this is From the Desk of the Professor.
I received the stunning news that Joe Madison, the legendary Black Eagle, was our newest ancestor in Dallas, Texas. Joe Madison was a towering figure in the storied annals of Black talk radio. In the early days of his career, when he burst onto the stage in Washington, D.C., Joe rapidly gained the respect of the audience as an uncompromising advocate for Black people who intentionally and famously dressed in black. Joe's staunch defense of the interests and aspirations of Black people was frequently accompanied by calls to action to advance issues of vital concern to our people. Going out on a picket line was not unusual for the Black Eagle. Joe Madison was a member of the National Board of Directors for the NAACP. Hence, he was not just a talk show host. He was a racial and social justice activist. In an interview with Joe, I called him a radio activist. He loved it and embraced it. The Black Eagle became the must-listen talk show host for Black America and anyone, friend or foe, who wanted to know what's going on with Black folks in America and the world. The Black Eagle would frequently adopt a cause and strenuously advocate for it until victory was won. He recently went on a prolonged fast to call attention to the urgent need for Congress to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill. His listeners responded because he had the gift of putting it where the goats could get it, as Joe would say. I fondly remember the Black Eagle going to Haiti with the Haiti Support Project after the devastating earthquake that rocked the first Black Republic. He broadcasted live reports. Joe turned the interviews from his journey with us to Haiti into an award-winning documentary. Such was the commitment and talent of the Black Eagle. We take comfort and inspiration in knowing that the legacy of our newest ancestor is secure. Joe Madison was and is one of the greatest and most effective radio activists ever. The Black Eagle will never die. He will always fly soar in the memories of a grateful people. We proclaim, long live the life and legacy of Joe Madison, the Black Eagle.
That viewpoint was ripped from the desk of the professor, Ron Daniels.
Radio personality and civil rights advocate Joe Madison has passed away. Madison spent years working with the NAACP before launching his broadcast career. He was a longtime radio voice here in D.C. and nationally on Sirius XM Radio. Madison made public his diagnosis with prostate cancer back in 2009. News 4's Mark Seagraves remembers Madison, who was part of our News 4 family.
Known as the Black Eagle, Joe Madison took his passion for justice from the civil rights movement to the airwaves.
Oh, no, no, no. Listen, brother, you and my on my school bus.
Madison was known for frequently posing the question, what are you going to do about it?
As he comes from a tradition of activism, and he understands that change only occurs when people actively take part in some form of movement or some form of struggle.
WAMU Radio's Kojo Nambi remembers Madison as a voice for those without one.
That passion is what characterized Joe Madison's entire career. This is a man who went on hunger strikes in support of causes that he was invested in. When you listened to Joe Madison, you picked up that passion yourself.
While in Detroit at age 24, Madison was the youngest person to lead an NAACP chapter. He went on to serve as the Civil Rights Organization's national political director and board member. In 1980, Madison began his radio career in Detroit before moving to Philadelphia and then D.C., where he appeared on WOL Radio before joining Sirius XM in 2008. In 2015, Madison set the Guinness World Record for the longest on-air broadcast, 52 hours straight. During the record-breaking show, he raised more than $250,000 for the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Madison was part of the News 4 family, appearing on our public affairs show, Reporter's Notebook, for years. Political leaders from President Biden to Mayor Bowser are among those who flooded social media with their tributes. Denise Rolark Barnes, publisher of the Washington Informer, D.C.'s oldest African-American newspaper, recalls Madison's early days at WOL Radio here in D.C.
He really had a passion, not only for journalism, but for the community that he served. And he, that information is power that WOL used to use all the time, I think was something that Joe planted there at WOL, because he felt as though folks need to know, they need to be informed.
But on my show, I'm telling it like it is.
Madison was a proud husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. His family announced his death on social media, noting he dedicated his life to fighting for all those who are undervalued, underestimated, and marginalized. Joe Madison was 74 years old.
Oh, just shut up. Goodbye.
In the district, Mark Seagraves, News 4.
If you have not been listening to Urban View the last couple of days, and you're just now finding out for the first time that the dean, the Black Eagle, has made transition, that happened. It happened. We announced it yesterday on the air after his family released a statement, which was sobering and at the exact same time inspiring, because the way we keep Joe Madison alive is by continuing to do the work, by picking up the baton. I am not, never have been. When I got here 9+ years ago, it'll be 10 years officially in August, and then October, Joe Madison had already established a standard on this channel that was called Urban View. Before it was called The Power. I know there's people asking for it to be returned to The Power. I'm completely okay with that, if I'm being honest. Urban View never really captured what this is. You know, we're not urban. You know, the people from all over the entire country and parts of Canada and parts of Mexico, not just the cities, there are people in rural places. And urban is code for Black. We know that in advertising, it's a signal, and it's not Black. 30% of our listeners are not Black. This is a channel that is gathered around some fundamental truths, that we are all on this globe together, that we all have similar wants and desires in our lives. We want safe communities. We want our children to be educated. We want to be able to be free. We want rights. You know, and that's kind of been the clarion call and the drumbeat of Urban View since I got here. And I took my lead from Joe Madison. So as we gather today, and I just, again, as I sit here, I was driving around today contemplating, you know, am I going to do a Foolishness? Yes, I have to do Foolishness Friday because we have to do radio. If this man did radio through cancer, if this man did radio for 52 hours to raise funds for a museum in Washington, D.C., if this man went on a 72-day hunger strike so that you and I could vote, I'm going to show up. I'm going to show up every day, and I'm going to do my very best, especially on these airwaves, because you deserve that. And that's the standard set by Joe Madison. So we're going to do that. And as I was driving around listening, first, Laurie Daniel Favors, oh, my God. But it started last night. I got a call from Laura Coates, who sat in that seat that Laurie Daniel Favors is currently in, 10 a.m. Eastern on Urban View. What are we going to do was the question. And I was like, we're going to continue the work. But then we started talking about, because last night on her show, which is on CNN, Laura Coates at 11 p.m. Eastern, she paid tribute at the end to Joe Madison. But there was a bigger question, like, what do we do? What do we do? And so we were talking about different things. She's like, well, maybe we can do 52 hours each. And I was like, no one should do 52 hours of radio. I said, to honor Joe Madison, and it shouldn't just be Urban View, which, you know, Laura's now on POTUS. But I know John Fugelsang posted something, Dean Obadala. I mean, everybody's been impacted by Joe Madison, not just on Sirius XM. So everybody should participate. So that was my contribution, that we're all going to do something. And maybe the 52 hours, because Joe Madison raised $250,000 during his Guinness Book of World Record performance. I mean, that thing, I was there when he, you know, I tapped in. I came in for like an hour to be with him. But I was like, 52 hours? Who can do that? Who does 52 hours straight? And he only could take bathroom breaks during the damn commercials. Nonstop. 52 hours to raise money so that we can have a museum in Washington, D.C. Hunger strike. Because it's outrageous that we don't have voting rights. Everyone should have voting rights in this country, the freest country, the best country in the world. We are okay with not everyone having the right to vote, or that places in this country where people are gerrymandered out of power. We're okay with that? So Joe Madison put his body on the line, literally, to fight for the things that we need. So I'm going to show up. And you're going to show up. Because that's what that legacy looks like. And that's how we keep Joe Madison alive. So we're here today on Friday. I was listening to Larry Daniel Faber's ex. Oh my God. It was so, I was just sitting in the car like, and let me just be transparent. For the last several weeks, of course, we have been playing best of Joe Madison, and he's got lots of years, 20 plus years of best of material to play. And I know a lot of people were concerned, a lot of people were reaching out. We knew when the diagnosis came in that it was going to be a very difficult journey for him. And, you know, all we could do was provide, you know, I lost my dad to the same disease. And those last months, those last months were some of the most difficult, because you see someone so strong, reduced to not being able to do the things. And somebody like Joe, like my daddy, you know, they won't stop until they have to be stopped by the disease. So I know that the difficulty in having Shauna Renee on the show, that was hard for her to come in to talk, knowing what she knew. So, you know, for the audience, and I appreciate this audience. It feels so much like family. I can't even express to you how much it feels like family to be here every day and know that y'all gave grace. Y'all gave grace, and you sat and you were like, okay, y'all prayed, and now we're here. And so I want to thank the family that we've created. A lot of us are born into families and we don't have choices there. But the families that you choose, the families that you choose to be a part of, the families that you develop, those are the ones that define you. Those are the ones that determine, you know, whether you're going to have support, you know, whether you're going to have the kind of life that you want to have. You get to choose the people that you want in your life. So we've chosen this. And then I tuned into Clay. I just was driving around today, tuned into Clay, and Vice President Kamala Harris called to pay tribute to Joe Madison on Clay's show. And I was like, wow, you know, she took time on her way to South Carolina, where they're having a primary, fighting for your rights to exist, because that's really what's on the ballot. It's not Biden and Trump. There's something so much more on the ballot, which is why we fight so hard. And I came into this year saying I wasn't going to go so hard in the paint, because people should have their minds made up. But Joe was going hard in the paint. And he wasn't an operative for the Democratic Party. Nobody was paying him to go hard in the paint. The man was the NAACP chair at some point in Ohio. As a matter of fact, I got an email from somebody last night, a brother named Reginald, and he said, hello, Ms. Hunter. I just this minute heard about Mr. Madison. In high school here in Detroit, I was wrongfully arrested doing an assignment for my economics class back in 1976. This is how long Joe's been doing this. And he said, my teacher, Mr. Rosenberg, put me in touch with Joe Madison, who was head of the Detroit NAACP. Let me correct myself, at the time. And Mr. Madison was cool. He was sharp and helpful. He got all the charges dropped. Mr. Madison was a G back in the day, and he cared for people's rights. Rest in power, Uncle Joe, the Black Eagle, sending prayers to Miss Sherry, his children, and to you, Miss Hunter, of course, and of course, our Urban View family. RIP, Mr. Madison. My inbox is full of letters like this, a loyal listener since the beginning, he says, Reginald, thank you. But this is all of our loss. All of us is not one single person who decided to pay for radio and then decided to become members of the Urban View family will not be impacted by everyone will be impacted by his loss. And this is a huge gaping hole. Nobody's going to fill it. It's not for me to fill. I came into Urban View saying I was going to find a space that I would fit in. I was going to get in where I fit in. I was not here to take over anybody's space. I listened before I came in and I was like, well, what's needed? And I'll fill in whatever's needed. But truthfully, a lot of it was already being taken care of. So I didn't have to do heavy history. Joe Madison was doing that every morning. You were getting your Black history. You were getting the interviews. Everybody came on his show. A lot of people won't come on my show. Everybody came on Joe's show. Because he was the place to go if you want to be asked those questions. And then if y'all called up with nonsense, you were going to get cussed out. You were going to get cussed out. I'm not going to cuss you out. It may feel like that. That is not my ministry. But his ministry was effective. And that cuss jar, I was like, who's going to inherit that? It won't be me. But as we sit here and we are, and I'm looking, yes, we definitely have guests. We're going to be doing a regular Foolishness Friday today. But I just wanted to just say thank you to all of you. But we will carry on because we will carry on. And all of us are now responsible to do something. What are you going to do about it? You have to answer that question. And then you have to do something. And I promise the only thing I'm definitely picking up the baton, I'm going to put it where the goats can get it. Hopefully I can break things down the way he did. That's going to be my commitment. But listen, all of us are doing that. So it's a collective effort. Not one person can fill those shoes. They are way too big. So I want to thank everybody who called up. Clay devoted his whole show. Larry too. Lots of calls. I was listening. Yes. So thank you. I just wanted to let you know that. All right.
I know a lot of you who listen to this program are probably saying, who the heck is Kevin and Rick talking about? Who is Joe Madison? Joe Madison has been a longtime activist and a radio personality for a number of years. Rick and I had interviewed him before he got really busy with Sirius XM and other entities. Years ago on the old WCXJ AM, where we had Joe on as a guest two or three times back then. So he's no one that's unfamiliar to many Black talk show listeners throughout the country. And it's amazing how a lot of white listeners, like maybe yourself, are totally unfamiliar with Joe Madison. So the way you can get familiar with him now is go back and listen to a lot of things that are in his archives. Rick and I definitely send our condolences out to his many listeners, family, and friends. Now, next up, we have a look at politics as usual, and this is from the program The Weekend. Before I go into the other segment, I wanted to mention one more thing. Something just came to mind to me. You know, over the weekend, we heard a lot about Mr. Carl Weathers, who played Apollo Creed. And, of course, most of the white radio stations and white TV stations would, really big up Apollo Creed and, you know, being in the Sylvester Stallone movies. But it's surprisingly, we have heard nothing about the passing of Mr. Joe Madison. Just wanted to point that out to you.
Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips is with us now. He is a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
So can we just start with the tweet? Because the people did not like the tweet. And I read it as you congratulating President Biden on whooping you. But I think people read it as you saying Joe Biden got whooped. Would you like to clear that up?
Yeah. Welcome to Twitter world. Of course who got whooped last night? I did.
Yeah.
My rear end's a little bit sore. And of course I'm congratulating the president. I predicted he would get 95%. He got 96%. I don't know how you could misread that tweet, by the way. I mean, if you look at the numbers, one person, actually two of us got whooped pretty good.
Mm. How do you?
So I hope I cleared it up.
Yeah, you did. So how do you, when you look at that whooping, how do you look at your campaign? And how should voters look at your campaign going into the next series of states? What's being served here? Because you got an incumbent president of your party who's pulling 96% of the vote in a very important state like South Carolina.
Sure.
Will pull a significant number of votes in subsequent states. So what does your path look like at this point, and why the full measure of what you're doing?
I appreciate it, Michael. It's a mission of principle, and I know tradition dictates that you always protect the incumbent. But I'm a Democrat who wants to win, and yes, he's dominating in the Democratic primary so far. I get it. But look at not the national numbers, as you just referenced. Mm-hmm. Look at the state numbers. Look at the lowest approval numbers in history. You know that Jimmy Carter was at 58% in January of 1980? Joe Biden's at 38%. You see the battlegrounds, all seven of them. I'm just trying to wake up our party. We are the progressive party. We should be moving forward.
So,
I see the writing on the wall.
Can I just say
let me just say one thing. In remember how you felt the morning after the election in 2016 versus the morning after the 2008 election? I want to focus on the 2008 election. Let's bring some energy and wake up our party and get young people energized. 4% turnout yesterday in South Carolina. 4%. Yes, it was a whooping. But my goodness, people are apathetic. They are staying home. They don't care. We got to wake people up. I'm trying to inspire a party right now. And a coronation, in my estimation, is the worst way to invite. We need invitation, not confrontation. We're not going to win unless we start opening our hearts and minds to this whole country.
So, Congressman, yeah. I hear you. And, you know, the campaign strategist in me is like, And we sit at the table and we talk a lot about the Republican primary that has been waged and how the candidates have just been unwilling to compete. And it's like, are they out there trying to win? Mm-hmm. And you say this is a campaign of principle. If you cannot win, you know, I worked for Senator Sanders in 2015, 2016. Lots of, you know, I like to say I've been where you've been. In a little bit. And a lot of the arguments that we would make about how Senator Sanders would do in a general election, it was a moot point, because if you cannot win a Democratic primary, you cannot get to a general election. And so what do you say to the fact that, yes, in New Hampshire, what you got about 19%, but the Democratic primary in South Carolina is a test of how primarily Black voters feel about
sure.
you. And you cannot be the Democratic nominee without Black voters. And so Black voters, they didn't come out and say, we're interested in Dean Phillips. So what is your path? Because coming up next is Nevada. You're not going to Nevada. You set your sights on Michigan.
Not on the ballot.
You're not on the ballot, but Nevada is next. And so I don't understand.
Well, first of all, I think I probably have 5% name recognition right now in the country. No voters know me. In fact, this is my first invitation to your network in 4 months, and I'm grateful to all of you. Sincerely, I mean that. That's my whole point. The GOP has had a competition. They're on TV. They're consuming hundreds of hours of primetime television, debates, town halls. CNN has given every GOP candidate a one-hour town hall. At least there's energy on the GOP side. We don't get energy unless there's competition. So when you coronate someone, especially a man like Joe Biden, who I respect, by the way, and I hope you know I respect Joe Biden, but at his stage in life, he is not inspiring people. We have no competition. We're absent on the airwaves. People don't care. You saw the turnout, 4%. And I'm trying to introduce myself. All I'm trying to do is wake up a party that I believe should have spirited competition to introduce a new generation of leaders. And by the way, when I came to Congress in 2019, I wanted Hakeem Jeffries to run right away. We've got to start elevating a young generation. We are suppressing voters and candidates and debate, and we're not inspiring. And it's time to wake people up. Someone had to do it. In that respect, I'm winning, and I'm going to keep going.
So the chairman in me.
the strategist and the yes. chairman, yes.
The chairman in me says, what the hell are you doing?
Sure.
Right? And why are you doing it? Because the reality of it is the party had a chance in 2016 mm-hmm. and in 2020 to make a different choice, all right? They did not choose Hillary. Mm-hmm. And in 2020, they had Joe Biden standing in front of them, and along with an array of other Democratic candidates, including the current vice president, and the party said no. Mm-hmm. So what makes you think that after that, with an incumbent president, Joe Biden's not going anywhere? He's not stepping down.
Mm-hmm. Big right? mistake, by the way. Big
matter,
mistake.
Matter of opinion, but individuals mm-hmm. make their choice. Sure. And in the process of making the choice to stay in the game, 97% of that 4% that turned out voted for him. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, in reality, are you creating a drain in the process, prolonging the narratives around his age, prolonging the narratives around other things that people are distracted by with Joe Biden, when the real threat mm-hmm. is the man across the aisle in Donald Trump? Mm-hmm. And the polling shows at the end of the day, Donald Trump is going to lose to Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. Second, final point on that. Mm-hmm. This is 2024. This sure. is not 2016. Mm-hmm. It's not even 2008.
Right.
Very different race, very different electorate. That's the other thing to keep in mind, that we've already seen an indication from the base of both parties where they want to go sure. in 2022. When democracy and the threat is in front of them, mm-hmm. the economy and all the other concerns take a little bit of a back step. So how do you sauce all of that narratively going forward when, as you tweet it, you're getting whooped?
Someone's got to do it. You know, my friends, I know every conversation you all have privately, it's probably the same ones I'm having with my colleagues, which is we're dumbfounded. And yes, he's got a commanding lead in the primaries. I get it. But look at the numbers. He is in a terrible position. The
Which
fact
numbers?
That Donald
Can
Trump,
we talk about the numbers? Let's be specific.
Okay, well,
what
first
numbers?
Of all, let's talk about historical approval numbers. He's in the 30s. No one's ever won re-election
yes.
with numbers like
let's
that.
Let's talk about the voters. Look,
let's talk about the seven. Yes. Let's talk, just forget national numbers. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Seven battleground states where he is, at least in the last Bloomberg poll, behind in every single one. But here's the bigger issue. We're living in this bubble here in Washington. When you get out around this country, as I've been doing, my goodness, it is shocking. And by the way, I'm going to wake everybody up right now. Donald Trump is listening to people. He gets it. The border chaos is absolutely front and center amongst Democrats who cannot believe that Democrats here in Washington are denying it and have been for years. Costs
Except
are
Except they had an opportunity. They had an opportunity.
In the last number of months,
and
hallelujah,
Republicans
finally.
Decided
of course,
to bungle
of
it.
Of course. But all I'm saying is that Donald Trump is listening. The man is a disaster for this country. We know it. And he is beating, in every meaningful poll in the battlegrounds, he is beating Joe Biden. And frankly, the country's made up his mind about his age. I'm just going to be forthright with all of you. All the talk about the past, wonderful bills that I voted for and helped market. I was a member of House Democratic leadership, infrastructure bill, CHIPS Act, Inflation Reduction Act, great investments in America. Americans are really suffering right now. 60% living paycheck to paycheck, 40% don't have $400 in the bank. And here we have the president and our party saying GDP growth is up, job growth is great. People are frustrated and they are fearful and they're seeing wars around the world. If we wake up, and my mission is to wake us up, I respect Joe Biden. He should have passed the torch. There are wonderful next generation candidates ready to go. I called them to inspire them. This was not a mission for me, but someone had to do this. And I'm simply saying the quiet part out loud. This is not a mission of antagonism. I'm not pointing out anything, Michael, mm-hmm. that is not clear and present and obvious. This notion of encapsulating him, don't debate, don't appear in front of voters, don't do anything unscripted, don't do interviews, don't do town halls. He's going to have to. And when people see it, it's going to be really difficult to overcome. And I only ran for Congress the morning after the 2016 election. My 16-year-old daughter was in her bedroom crying. She had just overcome cancer. She's a gay woman. I didn't know it at the time. I saw fear in her eyes like I'd never seen in my kids' eyes. I had to do something. I promised them I would. I ran for Congress, flipped a 60-year Republican district blue.
You
beat a guy who won by 14. And I lost that popularity. But my point is, I know how to win in red districts. I know what's going on with Trump's attraction, which is getting stronger, not weaker. And I'm trying to inspire our party
win the blue
to wake up.
You revoked your congressional
seat. But we're losing.
Mm-hmm. And so I do want to ask you, because since the start of this primary challenge, you've missed about 90%
sure.
of your floor votes. And I wonder what you say to the constituents you currently serve mm-hmm. about that choice.
I'll say another quiet part out loud. The people that really matter in these enterprises are staff, underpaid, hardworking, extraordinary young Americans who are taking care of all of our case files, all the constituent services that make the most difference in the world. I've told Hakeem Jeffries.
Matter?
Of course my votes matter. And Hakeem Jeffries knows very well, and I made the promise. Any vote of great consequence he needs me for, I'll be back for. That's why I'm here.
Vote, though.
That he needs me for.
Okay.
Look, folks, look, I activated, like a lot, millions of Americans because of Donald Trump. I was in the chamber on January 6th because of Donald Trump. Now he's walking back to the White House. I know most people know this. I know most people feel it. And yes, there's a chance Joe Biden could win. But in 2020, I think he was the only one that could. In 2024, he's probably one of the only ones that can't. And I'm not going to be quiet. My legacy, the blessing I want to share with my kids in this country is you don't just shush up and stay in line and be quiet when our country needs people, especially the best and brightest, most talented, most proximate. And they didn't stand up. So someone had to do it. Whether it's me or not, we'll decide. But I'm going to continue this mission because somebody has to inspire people to do what's really important instead of being quiet at a time we need to be loud. That's
my only
contention. I
know we have to go. One last question. Yeah. So, one, what is the red line for you to drop out of this race? And two, if you are not successful, which the numbers currently say you will not be, will you endorse and support and work to elect Joe Biden?
So here's the mission. I'm trying to build a model for Democrats to invite Americans to join us. We've lost huge swaths of this country because we stopped paying attention to them. Former President Trump is paying attention. I'm going to invite independents. I'm going to invite Republicans. I showed up at a MAGA rally just to say hi. I was greeted with decency and friendliness from 50 people waiting in the cold in New Hampshire. Many of them voted for Barack Obama. Many of them Bernie Sanders supporters. Many of them had never been to a Trump rally before. So I want to make a model for Democrats how we can win. I flipped a 60-year red district. We got to use invitation. And if I can demonstrate that over the coming months, we'll see polls that will present data to every Democratic voter and conventioners. Who's best positioned to beat Donald Trump? It might be Joe Biden. It might be me. Maybe somebody else will enter. But I think we have to inspire options for voters, and we're suppressing that right now. That's my contention. And the fact that you afforded me 5-10 minutes to at least express that to Democrats who have not heard that message makes me very grateful.
Congressman Dean Phillips.
Thank you, Alicia.
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is a commentary on the Black World Media Network.
Hey, this is Bill Fletcher, former president of Trans Africa Forum, longtime trade unionist and writer, back at you with a commentary. I was having breakfast with a friend the other day, and we were talking about the current political situation in the U.S., and he made this very interesting comment. He said, "Thank God Martin Luther King didn't have Twitter." Well, I looked at him and trying to understand where he was going with that. And what it came down to was a larger commentary on social media and political action. His point being not so much King himself, but the movements, let's say pre-1990, relied on real, honest-to-goodness organizing, in-your-face organizing, one-on-one organizing, engaging people, building organization, dealing with the challenges that come with organization, and that increasingly in the rise of social media, we've seen people move in this very strange way away from the building of organization and sustainable social movements and more in the direction of either mass actions with no follow-through or the assertion of individual identity and views through social media, particularly the notion of branding. So you have, in response to any number of horrendous things, people tweeting, texting, posting on Facebook, posting on Instagram or TikTok, but using that as a replacement for actual organizing and of getting people in the frame of mind where there needs to be organization built in order to fight to win. And actually, I would argue, in order to win political power. So that we have expressions of outrage, and you see it all the time on Twitter, Facebook, whatever, of all kinds of complaints about injustices, demonstrating in any number of ways about vicious atrocities taking place right now, for instance, in Gaza, among other places, Ukraine. But in terms of building organization, not enough. Just think about it for a second. In the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, there were massive protests around the United States, historic levels around the United States. And it felt as if we had hit a tipping point in the Black freedom movement and the broader social justice movement. But then, as will always happen, the protests died off, they declined. And what we were left with was very little. That is, it's not like we had a proliferation of new organizations built. It wasn't like we were positioned to build upon and police the victories that had been won. You know, whether it was anything from reforms in law enforcement to educational programs around race and racial injustice. Thus, with the decline of people in the streets, the right wing was able to reemerge, come back, and come on us ferociously. Let me give you a historic example, which is an analogy or a metaphor, but I think it will make the point. In 1864, there was something called the Battle of the Crater. It was in the Civil War, and it was when the city of Petersburg, Virginia, was besieged by Union forces. The Confederate forces had very strong defenses that were in place. The Union forces came up with this brilliant idea to dig tunnels underneath the Confederate fortifications and fill these tunnels with high explosives, and at a certain moment set them off and blow a hole in the Confederate defense lines. Well, they did this. Massive explosion took place, and it blew this tremendous hole in the Confederate defense lines. The Confederates were completely unsettled, and they started running, retreating at full speed. The Union forces were supposed to come through this line and pursue the Confederate forces. Instead, something odd happened. The explosion took place, and the Union forces went into the crater that had been created by the explosion. They looked around, and they were just mesmerized. All these body parts, the extent of the crater, and for some reason, it just sat there. At some point, the Confederate forces realized that they weren't being chased. They regrouped, they came back, and they massacred the Union soldiers who were in the crater. See, it wasn't enough to blow a hole in the defenses of the Confederates any more than it was enough in 2008 for Barack Obama to win the presidency, or in 2020 for the massive explosion of social protest around George Floyd's murder. Not enough. What was essential was to pursue our opponents and politically cripple them. But you can only do that with organization. Can't do it with Twitter. This is Bill Fletcher signing off. Have a good one.
That was a commentary on the Black World Media Network. Keep listening for more commentaries from the stellar minds of the diaspora.
On the Black World Media Network, this is Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats. Here is the reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs,
with a special Martin Luther King edition book bundle. I just wanted to mention some of the books written by Dr. King. Now, written, you know, there's written and there's written, right? Martin Luther King had a ghostwriter. His name was Stanley Levinson. And Stanley Levinson, you know, set up the framework basically for these books. What would happen is Martin Luther King would do a retreat in Jamaica or somewhere for like a month, something like that. And he would sit down with Stanley Levinson and they would hash out, you know, these books. So, you know, he was involved with these books. I'll say that. So let's mention a few. Why We Can't Wait, I think, is a very important book. It's about the Birmingham campaign. It's King addressing his critics who are saying that, you know, you're going too fast, et cetera. And he has explained why there's not such a thing as going too fast when it comes to injustice. A book that's not mentioned a lot is his book of sermons, Strength to Love, which I think is an important book about the reality of the human condition. So I think it's both a civil rights book and an important book of sermons. Now, Stride Toward Freedom was, I think, his first book, and that was his book about the Montgomery bus boycott that electrified the nation and put Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King on the map. I do want to point out, though, that probably his most important book is Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? And that's the book in which the radical king really steps out in an attempt to blunt the power, growing power of the Black Panther Party and Black militants. He lays out a radical agenda. So there's lots to read by Martin Luther King, not just about Martin Luther King. And I hope that you had a good King Day around the world. And of course, you know, King Day today is pretty much unofficially a day for the discussion of the oppression of the Palestinian people. And I hope that's happened around your area as well. I'm Todd Stephen Burroughs.
That was Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats, presented by reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs, journalist, historian, and popular culture enthusiast.
Next up, we have a clip from The Readout with Joy Reid on MSNBC.
The Democratic Party is a diverse coalition of voters, with a large part of that coalition being Black voters. If President Biden wants to win re-election, he has to make sure that every member of that coalition feels motivated to get out and vote. And right now, 10 months out from November, there's a lot of talk about how fragile the Biden base seems to be. Charlemagne the God is the host of the popular morning show, The Breakfast Club. His popularity with the youngins has put him in a unique position to impact the world of politics. He has praised and criticized both Donald Trump and President Biden, and interviewed politicians from Biden to Obama. And his sometimes contrarian views have brought him significant media attention, including this recent profile in Politico, which talked to him about the frustration some African-American voters, mainly Black men, are expressing about the Biden administration. Biden's deputy campaign manager, Quentin Fulks, who ran Senator Raphael Warnock's second senatorial campaign, recently addressed those concerns.
I know that it's not possible for a Democrat to be elected president of the United States without winning the African-American vote, and therefore our focus is going to be on making sure that we have those voters, that they know that we want to continue to earn their continued support or work to earn their continued support, and so that's where our focus is. But look, we've come out of the gate swinging. The other notion that I don't like when it comes to the African-American community is that it's Black men versus Black women, and I'm also not going to let that take hold in this campaign.
Charlemagne's new venture with politics and culture analyst, political strategist, and my friend, Angela Rott, and friend of the show, is aiming to give voice to the rising majority in America, which is who Biden needs to listen to if he needs to, if he wants to win. Their new podcast, Native Land Pod, launched this week on iHeart Podcasts and Reasoned Choice Media, which was co-founded by Charlemagne. Angela Rye is the co-host. I recently spoke to both of them, and I began by asking Charlemagne why the mainstream media, and particularly Fox, seems to be so obsessed with him these days.
I know what they're doing. They're using me and the things that I say about President Biden administration to say, see, look, Black people are totally, you know, fed up with Biden and his administration. I don't speak for all Black people. Black people are not monolithic. My name is Leonard McKelvey. They call me Charlemagne the God from Mount Corner, South Carolina. I speak for me and my perspective.
Yeah, who is your audience? Tell me the demo of your audience. Who are they?
I mean, it varies, right? Because I'm 45 years old now. So, you know, we've been number one, 18 to 34 the last few months, but we've also been in number two, 25 to 54.
Yeah.
So I think my audience is just a diverse group of people, like, you know, Black, white, brown. Like,
yeah.
I don't think it's just the youth, like some people may think.
But, you know, Angela, I mean, there is this whole conversation about our Black people pulling away from the Democratic Party. I mean, the numbers don't necessarily show it. Let's just put these numbers up. This is ages 18 to 34 overall. Biden not doing so well. He's in the low 40s. Trump's at 46. Black voters, it's still 69-20. I'm not even sure these numbers are accurate this far out from an election. Women voters of color, which is a mix, not just Black voters. You can see the numbers there. Two-thirds pretty much still support Democrats. Kamala Harris more popular, obviously, with Black voters than she is with voters overall. Do you, as a political strategist, you've been in this business, you've been in the political game, are these numbers meaningful, or is there a genuine problem that Democrats have with Black voters, and Biden specifically?
Well, here's what I want to say to you, Joy, and you know this, too, because you've also been not just in the business, but in the business of serving the culture for so long. I have been in meeting after meeting, both on the Hill and off the Hill, with the party mm-hmm. about their failure to reach their base, their most faithful base, 4 years. This is not new information. I don't know why we're surprised. I don't know why folks are, they said, I'm not holding them accountable on segments with them and all of that. Lenard is not saying anything different than what I've heard members, including the past chairs of the Congressional Black Caucus, say to the party. They're saying you're not investing enough in our community. Find the lie. Jamie Harrison will tell you that that is indeed the case, that they are working on it to change it. So why are we upset when people are pointing out the facts? The facts are enough Black consultants aren't hired. Tell me five Black pollsters you have. You can't because you have not created that bench. Tell me the Black candidates that you have. You've been forced to ensure that that bench is growing by the Congressional Black Caucus. You tell me the number of consultants you hire. Tell me with a fact, with a straight face, that white boys don't run the Democratic Party. Mm. And I'll call you a lie all day long.
Yeah.
Now, that does not mean that we should go and support a fascist. I don't think that either of us are saying that.
And that's what mainstream media never reports me saying, because I'm never saying, I may talk about Joe Biden and his shortcomings, but I also say Donald Trump is the end of democracy as we know it.
Yeah.
And we've seen it. Like, you know, he attempted a coup of this country to overturn, you know, the vote. So it's like we
And the votes of people who look like us.
That's right. That's so we see what he's capable of.
Yeah. And the question, though, I think, and you do radio, and I do love radio. I do miss radio, because you get to talk to people. Yeah. You get to talk to people and callers. So when people are calling you, and specifically Black people, what are they saying they feel they have not gotten out of having voted consistently for Democrats and for Joe Biden?
Upward mobility. Simple as that. Like, people want security, and a lot of that security is financial. Like, it's simple and plain. And it's been, whether it was President Obama, whether it was, you know, all the way back to Clinton to now Joe Biden, they feel like the Democratic Party has never promised that. And it's like, right now, the problem I'm having with my listeners, what am I supposed to tell them? Like, what am I supposed to tell them other than, look, man, Donald Trump is a fascist. You may think things can't get worse, but they absolutely positively can. But if they feel like, I've already lived through a Trump presidency, I lived through Reagan, how much worse can that get? Like, it's like, what do I tell them? They're not afraid of just telling them to go out and vote because, you know, because of fear anymore.
And, you know, the thing is, we saw, and, you know, you're not supposed to stand up and shout out in church, but we all watched what happened inside Mother Emanuel. And this was not Black people standing up. This was non-Black folks, but they were very passionate about Gaza. And you saw a Black woman, like, defend Joe Biden. That's the base that's going to vote for him, right?
Yeah, that's so the base that got him the 2020
in the
election.
Yeah. So when you're thinking about things like, we both talked about the sexy red thing offline, that, you know, people are like, I got a stimmy with Donald Trump's name on it, so I know I got it. Mm-hmm. When Biden sent me a stimmy, I don't remember it.
Yes.
On Gaza, it's a complicated thing because Black folks see those Palestinians and they see themselves.
Yes.
So with all of these issues, do you feel that the administration... Do they seem to understand that they do have a problem, particularly with younger Black voters, on economics, on Gaza?
I think that this is a complicated issue. And the reason for that is, you know, just as well as I, we have friends who work in this administration. We have some friends who have been in there fighting tooth and nail to ensure the administration doesn't just see it, but addresses it.
Right.
The problem that we have, I think part of what Lenard is addressing, is when a foreign country needs aid, the United States acts and promptly, and they will figure out a way to answer the call even without an act of Congress.
Yeah.
When it comes time for Black people to need aid, even a reparations discussion, people are like, wait, reparations? Right. Where? Why?
Right.
And that is really the problem. We have a people who are dying literally to feel heard, to feel embraced, to feel supported, to feel sacrificed for as much as we sacrifice at the ballot, even through voter suppression, even through a pandemic, through all of that. And that's the thing. So once, just meet us halfway, I think is the real
thing. Okay, very quick before we go, we're out of time, but let me play a clip. Can I play a clip? Play the clip.
It's nice to have a space, a safe space, as you talked about in the oath, where we can speak truthfully. And I think this is a podcast for everyone. If you have intellectual curiosity about your fellow countrymen who don't look like you, this is a place where you can come and hear that.
Very quickly, that name and that voice should sound familiar.
Yeah. Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross. Very quickly, tell us about Native Land Pod.
Native Land Pod is a project from Reason Choice Media, which we co-created with our good friend Chris Morrow.
That's right.
Native Land Pod, first episode dropped today.
Yes.
People are loving it. It's me, Andrew Gillum, and Tiffany Cross.
I love it.
Every Thursday. Radio, a longtime business partners. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Listen.
Enjoy. You something else.
I'm going to support my friends, and I love it.
Don't play.
We love
so excited about Native Land Pod. I will be listening. Charlamagne the God, Angela Rye, thank you both very much.
That's emotion in and of itself. Is the truest story, I think, for the majority of us in this country, the majority of us in our community, the majority of the listeners that we will hopefully have join us on this podcast. And they deserve to hear themselves, see themselves reflected, and know that a phoenix does rise. And so thank you for allowing me to partner with you and this brilliant woman next to me, Tiffany, two longtime friends and colleagues and brilliant women in this work.
I love that. Well, when we say welcome home, we're not just welcoming each other home, but listeners, we welcome you home too. Right. And again, it would not be us if we didn't just jump in where we know best. I want to start off, Andrew, with something that had you hot under the collar. Donald Trump, no surprises there, but basically he done it now. And he had something to say on the Civil War that you just weren't feeling. Let's roll that clip.
The Civil War was so fascinating, so horrible. So many mistakes were made. See, there was something I think could have been negotiated, to be honest with you. I think you could have negotiated that. All the people died. So many people died.
Oh, God.
Andrew.
Yo,
what's
this,
he on?
Well,
I
have to say, I think Donald Trump upped the ante in his vitriol, this time with black people as the target. And as the audience, the more fascinating side of the question is the hold of the Republican Party, 60% of which seem to be in these early states, standing right lock and step with him. I know that everybody thinks Donald Trump is disqualified from office or holding it again because of all these indictments and all that kind of stuff. But I got to tell you, if there's a disqualifier, it's that we've already experienced 4 years of that chaos. To me, that in and of itself is disqualifying, not that I ever thought he was qualified. But this idea of renegotiating the Civil War, we have to consider who he's talking about negotiating.
Right.
We're talking about people. Human beings, human lives. And I know Nikki Haley has a different spin on that, and we'll get to it.
Yeah,
but you can't, in this day and age, we really ought to all be up in arms that Donald Trump would enter into the political fray. He upped the ante from Nikki's comments of just ignoring slavery as a motivator for the Civil War, and basically said we could have negotiated our way around saving more white men and black men lives. Slaves fought in the war, former slaves, enslaved fought in the war, so on and so forth, to save people who look like him.
Well, I want
to me, it just blows my mind.
And Tiff, before you chime in on Donald Trump, I'm sure you got a lot to say there. I don't know if I agree with you on if he upped the ante on black folks, but we'll do more on that later. I do want to roll the Nikki Haley soundbite to see if you think there's that much light between their positions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the cause of the Civil War was basically how government was going to run, the freedoms and what people could and couldn't do.
Thank you. And in the year 2023, it's astonishing to me that you answer that question without mentioning the word slavery.
What do you want me to say about slavery?
No, you answered my question. Thank you.
Next question.
He said, enough said.
Yeah.
Look,
I just want to say to the listeners who are exhausted with hearing about Donald Trump, like, this is not a space where we will highlight this man every week by any means. But when he says something truly egregious, I do think he is the front runner of the Republican Party. And we have to talk about it and we have to address it. Closing your eyes, pretending he's not there is not going to make him go away. He is there. Two, I would say to Andrew's point about Trump's comments and Nikki Haley, they are talking to a specific set of people. They're not speaking to us. So all of this bullshit about they want to, you know, attract everybody to the Republican Party. No, they don't. They're speaking to racist, conservative, MAGA extremists. And we have to stop acting like, and Andrew, you said this, that the Republican Party is one and Donald Trump is another. This is the same people. You know, our good brother Michael Eric Dyson says this, Frankenstein was the doctor, not the monster. This is the monster they created.
That's
but
right.
They are by all means the doctor. All their racism, their xenophobia, their misogyny, he is the human embodiment of that. And so I'm never surprised. I'm never clutching my pearls. What I'm disgusted at is when I see this being consumed and discussed and parsed over across the media, that we can't call a thing a thing.
Right.
That these candidates are allowed to come on and wax poetic about all of their bullshit issues that they invent And they're never confronted with, but what about your racist ass comments that you said yesterday? That's why they go on these shows, because they know it'll be an easy pathway. They won't ever be confronted with it. Everybody on the panel will pretend, you know, that they're not going to talk about this. Even their voters. I think their voters have to start being confronted. When you do these, you know, voter panels and talk to people, I don't know how you have that kind of panel and you don't ask, well, how are you comfortable with some of the racist comments that he's made? How are you comfortable with how he speaks about your fellow countrymen? And so,
literally quoting Hitler.
Absolutely.
You know,
everything about him is so un-American in the ideology that we have, that the hope of what we think this country could be. But it's also so very American,
yeah,
in the way that this country was founded. So I'm disgusted by it. I'm unnerved by him continuing to be the front runner. And until media, which I do think has a very important role to play in democracy, until they start assuming that role in a more responsible, inclusive, aware way, I think they're helping to pave the way to America's final season.
Textbook enabling. And one of the things, too, we throw in the Nikki Haley clip. We make it seem, or they have made it seem over time, like Donald Trump was the anomaly. You referenced this Frankenstein analogy that Harry Reid actually said. He said that Donald Trump was the Republican Party's Frankenstein. You built this monster.
Yep.
Your dog whistles are now foghorns. Like, let's be very clear about what it is. This same thing that he's doing, doubling down on the Civil War, paved the way by state policy where they're challenging CRT. Now it's DEI program. So we went from critical race theory to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And Donald Trump is like, oh, there's an obsession with Civil War. It turns out the Confederate soldiers were born again and showed up at the Capitol on January 6th. No surprises here at all. So I'm curious to know about your new vitriol, because it's been vitriol.
I'm not new to the game, and I'm not new to the tactics of Donald Trump. I find it strange the timing of wading into this. And I don't think that Donald Trump and Nikki Haley's comments are the same. Nikki Haley also, first of all, she's a contradiction in walking, because she's also the same woman who took down the Confederate flag and removed the Confederate statues off the state's grounds in South Carolina. That's what made many of us think that she was a reasonable person. If slavery had nothing to do with the Civil War, the Confederacy, then why was it so politically risky for her to then remove those monuments?
Well, you know what's changed.
I know exactly what's changed. But to make the difference between what Trump is saying, I have not heard a Republican in mainstream, certainly not someone who has pursued the presidency, say we should have renegotiated that and a lot of lives could have been saved.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section. When Dad injured his back, when your basketball star tore his ACL, opioids helped with the pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Opioids are powerful pain-reducing prescription medicines, but most people who are prescribed opioids don't finish their prescriptions. So millions of unused opioids are sitting in homes across the country, and tragically, more than 100 Americans die every day from overdoses involving opioids. What can you do to protect your family? Remove the risk of unused opioids from your home. Pills, patches, or syrups in drawers, purses, and cabinets. Anywhere they might be hiding. To find out how to dispose of them properly, visit www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
what kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
Teachers shape the future. Right now, in a classroom somewhere in the United States, there's a teacher inspiring a future scientist who'll make preventing pandemics their life's work, sharpening the mind of an aspiring environmentalist who'll help combat climate change, and generating possibilities for a student who'll be the first in their family to graduate college. Explore a career that leaves a legacy you can be proud of. Teach. Learn more and receive free support at teach.org.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Kevin Amos, and this is the Jazz Corner.